Welcome to Teamwork, A Better Way, the podcast filled with stories, experiences, and insights from leading high-performing team experts. Here are your hosts, Spencer Horn and Christian Napier.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Teamwork, A Better Way. I'm Christian Napier, joined by Spencer Horn, and beautiful spring colors there, Spencer. How you doing?
Happy Easter. I'm doing great. Well, happy Easter yesterday. Doing fabulous. Feeling springy, yes. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Yeah, Easter was yesterday, and we had a great Easter weekend. Today is April Fool's Day, and your mouse decided to play an April Fool's joke on you because it stopped working right when we were going live.
Right when we were going live, we technology, yep. So you may see me go off the screen for a second to get it so I can control some of the things that we have going on here. But good to be with you, Christian. Happy April Fool's Day.
Yeah, it's great to be with you. How was your Easter weekend?
You know, it was great. I mean, I went on Saturday I went for, you know, my obligatory hike up in the mountains, and with just the rainy, drizzly weather we've had, it was just muddy. And so I tried to find some more gravelly trails and got a lot of mud. But my basement is finished. So we,
congratulations,
getting everything set up down there now to have guests over and our entertainment center. So that's exciting. And then we had family over and had our first little family activity downstairs in the family room for Easter. That was wonderful. How about your Easter? Awesome. How was that?
It was, you know, rainy and cold and hail and all that kind of fun stuff, but it was great to get together with family. So yeah, we had a nice dinner on Sunday yesterday, and it's all good. Now we're back to work on April Fool's Day.
That's right. Hey, we have Quinn. Sorry, Quinn, I can't put your post up on the just yet. I'll try to do it later. But Quinn Jones says, "Good to see you both. Good to see you. Thanks for joining the show."
Yeah, always grateful to have Quinn join us. And Spencer, you sent through a text to me. Whenever it was, over the weekend maybe, with an article that you had seen on Boeing, and a very interesting article, and I'm looking forward to talking with you about that. And also, you're writing an article, and you shared some ideas on the article that you're writing, and I think it's what you're proposing, I think, is really brilliant, and gives us a different way to look at our responsibilities from a leadership perspective. And so I'm really eager to talk with you about the concepts that you're coming up with in that wonderful brain of yours.
Thank you. That's so nice of you to say, but I appreciate your perspective in helping me make those ideas even better. As I sometimes stutter on the show to get the ideas out, you are someone that seems to congeal ideas very well and speak so eloquently. But for me, this topic that we have titled today, I think may surprise a few people. The idea that the divinity of the human soul is a fabulous business principle. You know, so often we hear, you know, great communication, treat your people well, all that is well and good. What happens if we raise that another level? And like I said, maybe I raised a few eyebrows out there. So I'd love for you to just hold your horses and listen in. Have you ever had someone, Christian, just make you feel special, or at least that you had great worth?
Yeah. Now there are people in my own personal life that do that, right? But from a business perspective, I would say that there have been people that I've worked with in the past who have made me feel important and needed and appreciated. And I was having a conversation with someone earlier today. Hey, you know, I don't have to make all the money in the world, but if you treat me with respect, with kindness, I will walk over hot coals for you, you know, like, because I know that it's valued. you know, and I know that it's helpful to somebody. And so that's kind of my meandering answer to your question. Yes, I have felt that in the past, and I know you have as well, especially with one of your great mentors.
Yeah, and it is transformational. I mean, people are committed to people that really help them. I mean, for me, being made to feel that I have value and can make a difference makes all the difference in my level of commitment, my desire to focus, my desire to walk on coals if I have to, as you say. But more importantly, the confidence that comes from understanding my potential and what I can become from somebody that makes you feel that way is so empowering. And I think that's something that not enough people have experienced in their life. And I believe that when you do experience that, there's a transformation that takes place. I mean, you've heard of, in literature, we have all these ugly duckling stories, right? I mean, the duckling that grows up to be, you know, a swan, and I have my own ugly duckling story. But in movies, going back to history, I mean, we have Shakespeare, The Taming of the Shrew, which was made into a movie, 10 Things I Hate About You, and, you know, Pretty Woman, and She's All That, and all these ugly duckling stories of someone who was treated well. And or Johnny Lingo. I don't know if anyone is familiar with the myth of Johnny Lingo, or the legend of Johnny Lingo, actually, and the eight cow woman of Mahana, right? And how people transform when we treat them like they have great worth. Now, that's different than the Pygmalion effect. I don't know if you're familiar. Have you ever heard of that? The Pygmalion is also a story that is a Greek myth, right? Of the sculptor who created this sculpture that was so beautiful, he actually fell in love with the sculpture, and the sculpture came to life. And that's a great story. But in business, that's sometimes called the Pygmalion effect. If we create high expectations for people, that they'll rise up. That's not what I'm talking about, because science research has shown that's not quite true, especially for women in the workplace. Creating higher expectations for them doesn't really have the same effect as it does for some of the men. What I'm talking about is not just expectations, but actually treating people as if they already have great worth in your organization. And I know as a 26-year-old coming out of college, and you know, as an operations manager, I was failing, and I had the opportunity to make some changes in my approach and in my leadership. And I had a conversation with my mentor, Kelvin, and he's like, listen, you know, you have so much more. And he said, I need you to be able to step up. Now, those were expectations, but he didn't belittle me. He did everything he could to help me. He made me feel like I could be there as a successful executive. And after the 6-month period of when he said you had to make these changes, he promoted me. And he always, even though I could have failed that, I was in a situation, Christian, where I could have walked away and felt, well, if he's going to, you know, create those kind of standards for me, I'm going to leave. He doesn't appreciate me. But just as you said, because of the relationship I had with him, I needed to walk on coals and make that transformation. And that's what I did. But that wasn't just because he had high expectations. It's because I knew he cared about me. I knew he wanted my success. He treated me with great dignity, and he did that with everybody. And I'll share some of those results as we go through. I just wanted to hear what your response to that.
Well, my response, well, I guess, just to give people backstory, why don't you tell them a little bit of the backstory of Kelvin? Because if I recall, I mean, he was a CEO of two publicly traded companies. And you know, so just kind of putting things into context.
Let me go back even further before that. So Kelvin, and I'm writing about him in my book, which I hope to have come out in a few months. I mean, my goal is July, but he worked for his father in the furniture business in Oklahoma. And he describes his father as a benevolent dictator. His father was controlling every way that, you know, the business ran. And there was an opportunity for his father to serve a mission for his church in England. And so he left for 3 years and left the business in his son's hands. Now, Kelvin was that young executive, and he wanted to do things differently. And so one of the things that he learned very early on is that, you know, they were a sales-driven organization, but the sales team had never participated in the goal before, ever, because it was always controlled by the dad and how he ran the business. Kelvin decided he wanted to open that up and give the team an opportunity to participate in the sales goal. And he made an incredibly high goal, like back then, you know, $50,000 in a month. And that was a big goal for them. But he solicited all this input. And what he found is that when he brought the team into the goal, they cared more about hitting the goal than they did making the paycheck for themselves. And they became all in on this goal. And he treated them as partners in achieving that goal. He did other things with them to have them participate in the business and treat them like they were important and not just, you know, I want to use the right words, but not just, you know, a cog in the machine that could be replaced, that they were valued. And he learned so many valuable principles through those experiences of contrast between some different styles of leadership and how people responded to that. And he became a successful CEO of a medical device company called Dynatronics here in Utah, and then started a second publicly traded company to develop entertainment centers in tourist destinations. He created this company called International Tourist Entertainment Corporation, or ITEC Attractions. And he hired me out of college, this unproven kid with a master's degree, and he gave me a chance. And the interesting thing was, is he didn't, I don't really think he cared as much how much I knew as how I treated people in my life. And so as part of the interview process, Christian, we were going to create our first theater in Branson, Missouri, which is a kind of a senior citizen vacation spot, right? And it's such a fun place to go, but it's known as, you know, the silver hair or the gray hair type of Nashville, right? It's country music, but it's for older folks, and maybe over the hill country music stars go to retire there. And so we were going to build our first theater there. And as part of the interview process, he required my wife to join me in flying to Branson. Now, why would he do that?
Well, he wanted to make sure that you treated her well, and that she was fully on board with things, I assume. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. He actually wanted to see, he wanted to get to know her, because he knew that if she was a quality person, which she is, as you know, much greater quality than me, that said something about me and my ability to have good people in my life. But he also wanted to know how I treated her. And he wanted to see how I interacted with people in the community. Would I be humble? Would I be proud? Would I represent the company well? His idea was, as a CEO, I want to surround myself with great people, even people that are smarter than me, and let them shine. And he said, you know, if it was always about me and my abilities and my knowledge, then we're going to have trouble as a team. I want to elevate and lift other people up and give them opportunities to grow. But that starts with character. It starts with good people. And so that's what he looked for above all else. And if you were smart and talented, of course, that's that's a great plus.
So where did the phrase, the divinity of the soul is paramount, come from?
Great, great question. I never knew that phrase while I worked for him. I just saw him in action, and I just saw how he treated everyone, his wife, the respect that he treated her with, all the employees, the respect. He had definitely had high standards. I mean, I told you he kind of gave me an ultimatum, right? Otherwise, he would have to make a change. But he treated our tenants with respect. He treated business partners with dignity and respect. He gave me of his time. People love working for Kelvin. He was, you know, in his 60s, so maybe a little bit older than I am now. He was athletic. He played racquetball, and he was so funny. He would just, you see, as soon as he found out that somebody played racquetball, he would just totally sandbag him. Oh, hey, would you come play with me? I'm an old guy. And he would wipe the floor with him. He was very competitive, but he was fun. We had fun at work. He made work a blast. And, you know, he was just giving. And I was just so surprised at how people were willing to work so hard for him. And so I've been writing down many of these experiences, and I'll share more of them as we go today. But as I was writing these experiences down, I said, you know, I need to interview Kelvin. And he's getting, you know, I believe he's close to 90, if not in his 90s. I forgot how old, I can't remember exactly how old he was. And so I texted him. I said, Kelvin, how old are you? And he never responded. But he's getting older. And I want to make sure that I captured some of his thoughts before he left the earth. And so one of the things that I asked him was, I said, just nonchalantly, I said, you know, so Kelvin, what is your business philosophy? What drives your leadership style? And without hesitation, he said, the divinity of the human soul is paramount. And, wasn't the, you know, the dignity of the human soul. He said the divinity of the human soul. And it's interesting. I feel like, you know, that doesn't mean you're going to, if you treat everybody like they're, you know, potential superstars, that your business is going to be great. I mean, the business that we had ended up filing bankruptcy. Well, it was more circumstantial because of a failed fundraising, which came from a hurricane in the Caribbean. There's so many things that are linked, and the company is still successful now, but they went through a reorganization, and that reorganization process was very, very difficult. I left right when that was happening. I went to Kelvin. I said, listen, it looks like, you know, things are we're not able to do our next theater, and that's what you hired me for. Should I be looking for another job? And he said, yeah, probably. And I was sad, but I left the organization, you know, on positive terms and wanting to do what was best for the company and for me at the time. And so I left when they went through this whole bankruptcy situation, Christian. And what's interesting is he told me the company that wanted to hire, buy them was another company from here in Utah. And they went to the bankruptcy judge and really kind of talked very poorly about the company. And so the bankruptcy judge was not initially very kind to Kelvin and our team. And he just continued to do what he always does, and you know, it made him very difficult to kind of respond to all the judge's demands. But what started happening is he treated the other company that was blackballing him well. He treated the creditors well. The shareholders all loved him. And pretty soon, what started happening is that the creditors started standing up to the judge on behalf of Kelvin, just because of the relationship that he was able to build with him. And it wasn't an act. It wasn't just something to get them on a side. He was surprised. He's like, they're now talking. These are creditors that we owe money to. And they're like, judge, they're doing a great job. Back off. And if that makes sense, and it saved the company. Now, I wasn't there when that happened, but that's just an example of how this principle of no matter what situation you're in, even if it's a dire situation, you treat people as if they are greater than just this lump of clay that we are today, that they're more than that, and you treat them with dignity and respect, and it's amazing what will happen.
Well, that's a fascinating story. I had not heard that story before. I know you've talked at length about Kelvin and the impact that he's had on you, but I wasn't aware of all of that backstory. So I appreciate you giving us this additional context. And I know that there, when you say a word like divinity, it might have religious connotations and things. And we're not on this podcast anyway, trying to be divisive in any way about
exactly
about theology or anything.
No,
but I think the point of it, the point of you bringing it up is when you are having an interaction with another person, is to make sure you're wearing the proper set of lenses, you know, that will allow you to understand who they really are and then act accordingly, right?
Or even who they can become if who they are is not what you need right now. That's the ugly duckling story, right? You treat people who they can become, and they'll eventually transform into that beautiful swan. I mean, I don't know that I'm a swan. I mean, mostly, but definitely transformed into something better than I was.
And what was really interesting about the experience that you shared there, Spencer, was not only did he feel that way about his employees, but he felt that way about everybody, even the people who were his adversaries, right? The people who were acquiring the company, the judge, they were potential adversaries. But he continued to go about his business and building relationships of trust with them as well, which is, I would say, not super common in today's environment, right? We're often taught to take advantage of windows that people open, and it's an us versus them. It's, for us to succeed, they must fail kind of attitude. And it doesn't sound to me like that's the attitude that Kelvin had.
Kelvin did not have that. And it's interesting. There's more to the story, because I didn't know this part of the bankruptcy story about this other company treating them poorly. I did know that they were trying to buy us. And so I got to know them. And when I left, I went to work for another company to build a theater. And then that opportunity ended. And so I reached out to that company, to that CEO, and he hired me on a short-term contract. And so I went to work for that other company about 2 years after this. And completely different experience. Here's somebody that, that talked the moral game, but did not treat people the same way. I was there for maybe a year on, short term, 2 6-month contracts. And the culture was so different. It was all about profits and bottom line. And of course, that's why we're in business. And I think about how much pride I had in working for Kelvin versus for this other individual. It's not even close. How much harder I worked for Kelvin compared to this other individual. And I like some of the people that I worked with, but I didn't have a high performance team experience that, I think about your experience with the Salt Lake Olympic, committee that you worked for. And that's an experience that was a transformational experience for you, right? I mean, you think back, and it's so rare to have those experiences, but it came from incredible leadership that you experienced. So the same was true for me. Less than 12% of teams worldwide are high performing. And according to that article that was published in Harvard Business Review in January, less than 9% of 1,000 executives from all over the world that were studied feel like they're a part of high performing teams. So anywhere from 8 to 12%, maybe 15% if we're generous, are even high performing. That means there's a lot of people out there that are struggling to have positive experiences in the workplace because they have leaders that don't treat them with the respect of a Kelvin.
Or so maybe my question to you, Spencer, as we're having this conversation, my question to you is this: can this be learned, right? Because, you know, Kelvin was who he was, and that's fantastic, but I'm not Kelvin. You're not Kelvin. You know, our listeners, our viewers, they are not Kelvin, right? So can we develop leadership traits that help our employees and our customers? And, you know, should we be working in public institution or publicly traded companies, you know, our shareholders or our stakeholders, you know, that help them feel valued and appreciated? Because I might listen to this and say, well, you know, that, you know, Kelvin sounds like he's amazing, you know, but I'm not him. Like, I'm part of the 88%, you know, of of low performing teams, or one of the 91% or 92% of executives who feel like I don't belong to one of these high performing teams. So what can I do?
Well, that's a great question. And good news is there's hope, because there is one characteristic that is required to create a high performing team, and kind of the buy-in that we've been talking about, the ability for people to quote unquote want to walk on hot coals, and that's trust. You create trust on your team as a leader, and you will have the results that you want. Well, how do you do that? What's the leadership style that does that? Well, over 1,000 studies of identifying which leadership style creates the best results or trust, all of them agree that there's no one answer. There's no one style. So it doesn't have to be Kelvin's style. It can be Christian's style. And the key is that you are authentic to you. And you create trust in a way that people connect to and relate to. I'll give you some examples of the things that he did that I think created trust, if that's helpful.
Yeah.
And then we've got, hey, Quinn, it's working now. So here, profit efficiency and control are much of the attention of businesses focused. You're right. And we're going to actually talk about why that can sometimes create a problem. And we have an article which we'll talk about, Quinn. You're exactly right. That when we focus on those things first, we don't create a strong foundation for our organization for trust to thrive. And when there's not a strong trust, communication flounders. You have to have trust to have open and honest communication. When you have that open and honest communication, people are more clear about what's expected of them. When they know what's expected of them, they have clarity as to their roles and goals. And that leads them to more focused action, which then leads to profit and results that we're talking about. So, and then he says, you said it, ask your team what it feels like to work on a high-performing team. It's actually, Quinn, one of the things I do when I do a team diagnostic, I say, who here has ever been on a high-performing team? I don't care if it's a sports team. I don't care if it's, you know, your debate team or a band, whatever it is that your Cub Scout or Girl Scout troop. List that. And then I have them list all the characteristics that made that experience high performing. And it usually comes down to how they feel about the team members, how they interacted with each other, how they had each other's back. And basically in a sense that trust. So here are some of the things that Kelvin did that I think anybody can do regardless of your personality or leadership style. He taught me to respect my time and his time. He willingly spent time teaching me and other members of the team about business and the plan. And so I knew where we were going and how I could be successful. He was developing me, his direct reports. And he helped me grow personally and professionally. he did this on his terms, though. He didn't, I couldn't just barge in on him. I mean, he was the CEO of two publicly traded companies. So he taught me to respect his time, and I learned how to respect my time as well. He was fine letting me struggle with problems for a time to figure things out. He didn't just have to have all the answers himself, because if you have to have all the answers, then you take the spotlight off of your team and back onto you. Remember, he said, I wanted people smarter than me. It didn't need to be about me. It needed to be about them. And, you know, his approach taught me to be more disciplined, and I was prepared for meetings. When we went into meetings, I was respectful of the executive team's time. How often do we show up in a meeting? It's like, okay, I'm here. You know, what are we going to talk about? No, show up, because if you're taking everybody else in that meeting, their time away from important work, it better be good. He always used to say, it takes a good meeting than to have no meeting at all. So come prepared so that you can add value to the rest of the team and respect their time. And even if we were talking about problems, he wanted that time that we had to be valuable for both he and I and the team. He taught me to balance competing principles, like noticing details and focusing on and not losing sight of the big picture, like creating a healthy culture that would create a great environment for our customers, noticing garbage on the ground and never being too important to pick it up. I know that sounds so simple, but how do you create confidence and humility without making somebody too proud to be able to do the little things and the, you know, the things that need to happen every day that you expect your team to do? He treated everyone with dignity and respect, and he let people know that they were needed and wanted and missed, and he was caring for them. He would, you know, 3 decades before Richard Branson ever said, you know, treat your people the way you want them to treat your customers, that's what Kelvin was teaching us. And he was funny. We joked around. We had this restaurant that we ran, and he put 2 tables on these. The tables were on a piston that would rise about 10 inches over half an hour. And so it was imperceptible for the people that were sitting at the table, but we would talk to everyone around the table saying, look, watch what's happening. And they would just start giggling, because people would be like scooping the food straight from the table to their mouth and almost didn't even realize what was happening. But we would give them like free pie for being good sports and just have fun with it. And, you know, those are some of the things. That's the kind of fun. He was able to joke around and not take himself too seriously. And so you wanted to come to work. And to me, anybody can do that. But if you want to make it all about you and you know more than everybody else, even if you do, what's the impact of that? You have all the answers. Well, then no one's going to take any initiative, because they only will wait forever for you to make a decision and tell them what to do. Or if they do and you tell them, well, that was the way I wouldn't have done it that way, then again, there's no initiative. There's no desire to try new things. There's no ownership whatsoever. And you need your people, even though they're not owners, to take ownership of their responsibilities. And that only happens when you give them some freedom. So those are some of the things that I think anybody can do.
So I have a thought on this, Spencer. It just occurred to me. You know, I've been, over the past couple of weeks, I've been having conversations with a number of managers, like director level people primarily, or manager level, and asking questions related to the success of projects that they've delivered in the last year or so, right?
Yeah.
And what were the reasons for that success? And the number one reason was they established good communication. They figured out ways to work together. But the number two reason for that success was they felt like, you know, this particular project succeeded because it was mandated by the executives. This thing has to work. We have to get this done. We have a hard deadline. And in some, not all cases, and I'm still having conversations, so this is not like the be all end all, but the trend is showing that, well, if the executive team shows is reflecting that this is a priority, this has to get done, and especially if they allocate additional reasons, we're going to pull a person off of this project, we're going to assign them to your team to help you, right?
Well, then that shows that
the projects are successful,
right?
And so the takeaway from that, when it comes to what you're talking about, is the team will basically reflect the priorities of the executive, right? So when it comes to building this kind of a culture, you know, if the executives really want it, it's going to happen. You know, so the question is how, coming back to Quinn's question, you know, how can executives if complement is the right word, but you know, he uses the words profit, efficiency, control is where the business attention's focused. So how do the executives, you know, create this culture acknowledging, to use your words, the divinity of the human soul is paramount. And then everything else will work out, you know?
Well, that's a good question. And I think that a lot of people listening are asking that same question. Because it's like, well, if you're just focusing on that, won't everything fall to pieces when it comes to profitability? I mean, that's what you're asking, right? If we don't focus on profitability, and here's the answer, they're not mutually exclusive. You can treat people with dignity and still focus on profit. I mean, we were a publicly traded company. He ran two publicly traded companies. That means that we have a responsibility to shareholders to create a return on investment. The mandate was for us to be profitable. And we had, as I was a public officer, I was the vice president of that publicly traded company. I had liability if we did not care for our investors' investment. I personally could be liable. That's a lot of responsibility for a 27-year-old kid. But we took that responsibility seriously. We returned and reported to our board, to our shareholders regularly. Here's what's going on. Here are the problems. Here are the problems that we see. So when, for example, we were getting ready to do our next public offering, our next theater was going to be in St. Thomas, the Virgin Islands. Well, what happened in 1996? When was it? I think it was 1996. Yeah, big hurricane came to the Caribbean, wiped out the islands. So all of the construction services were no longer available to us. And so the fundraising failed, and that's cash that we needed to, we were still a startup, and we didn't have that available to us anymore. And so we were very transparent about what's going on and what's happening so that shareholders knew that, you know, there's bad news. And because of how we were honest, no matter what, we weren't trying to, you know, cook the books or hide things from them. They were patient with us. They understood that the company had growing pains and that there was going to be setbacks. But that the point is treating people as if they, you know, the divinity of the human soul, as that they were important people, didn't mean that you couldn't fire people. Didn't mean that, you know, because if you have somebody on the team that is treating other people with disrespect or not respecting their role or pulling their own weight and, you know, and not taking feedback or training or creating a bad environment or countercultural, you can't have that on the team. This isn't the team for you. I mean, some people aren't... How do I say this without making it sound, you know, religious? I don't think some people will be comfortable in heaven, so they need to go somewhere else, right? I'm joking, but that's the point. Is it's you're not just playing harps, you're working hard, and we never lost focus of what we were there for, and that's to return. Create a return on the investment from our investors.
If I Okay, so I like the word that he uses, which is this is paramount, right? So when you say paramount, you're basically saying this is the most important thing,
Most
right?
important
It
thing, yes.
is the most important thing. And, maybe an investor or a shareholder might look at that and be a little bit confused, like, well, no, I mean, the most important thing is for me to earn a return on my investment. That's my most important thing. You need to generate a return on my investment. And I think what Kelvin is saying is to give us the best chance to earn the optimal return on your investment, we need to treat everybody accordingly, right?
Right.
It is a means to an end, but it's also more important than that, right? So treating people or recognizing the divinity of the human soul's paramount is, I would assert that it's more than a tactic
It is
or
more than
even a strategy,
that's right.
right? It is a core value, and that core value will drive optimal returns for your stakeholders. It will drive culture. It will drive your team's performance more than looking at the quarter by quarter statistics
Yeah.
and
I
those
mean,
kind of things.
so many of what Wall Street looks for, Christian, is perverse in terms of its long-term sustainability, right? Because you can have profit for a short period of time, and some investors are only interested in a short-term return. Well, that creates all kinds of problems. Look at a company like Costco. When those founders started out, they said, "We are going to pay people, our hourly people, more than usual." I mean, and they paid them a lot. And investors are saying, "Well, why would you do that? That's not going to create a profit the way if you were to just slash that and create the biggest margin possible." No, we're going to pay our people first. We're going to take care of our people first. And if you look at Costco's stock value, every year it continues to grow in value every year. And because they didn't follow the Wall Street wisdom of profitability first. I probably told this story before, but think about there's a restaurant here in town years and years and years ago that was very popular. It was a fish restaurant called Bratton's on 7th East and 4th South. And I can see still picture that little fish hanging down. And Bratton's was famous for this incredibly creamy clam chowder, a New England style of clam chowder. People would wait outside the restaurant at lunchtime just to get in to get some of this clam chowder. Well, the original owner sold it to another company that was just interested in profits, and they're like, "Well, they're spending too much on these high quality ingredients. We can make more profit if we water that down." And guess what happened when they did that? Profits went up.
For a
Profits.
time.
For a time. Pretty soon those lines were no longer there because people realized, well, it's not the same. The quality is not there. What I'm paying for, I'm not getting the value of what I wanted. And so the sustainability of that profitability was gone and they went out of business. So anyway, that's what I'm saying is that you get to continue to focus on profitability, but sometimes if you only focus on profit, we have a story that has just come out in Boeing. I wanted to talk about that as a company here in the United States that's going through a lot of problems right now. I'd love it if you'd share some of the history of what you were sharing with me earlier today about Boeing Corporation.
Well, it's not necessarily mentioned in the article, but there was a great documentary on Netflix about Boeing and situation. This coming on the heels of the issues with the MCAS system that ended up causing two Boeing 737 MAX airplanes to crash, killing hundreds of passengers, and then freezing all of the active or planes that were in service, you know, so they couldn't fly. They were not certified to fly again. And then, you know, Boeing was not able to deliver all those airplanes. But why did that happen? And it was a decades long. And again, I'm not an expert on Boeing. I'm just reflecting on what I saw in this documentary. And I know the documentary shows one point of view and there are many perspectives out there. So I don't purport to be any kind of expert here. But well, what it shows is a story that is similar to the story about the restaurant that you just shared with Bratton's, where Boeing, you know, started out in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and then going on into the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, being a very engineering-driven company. The leadership were engineers. They were hyper-focused on the quality of their product. And then when they merged with McDonnell Douglas in the 1990s, the McDonnell Douglas culture was more focused on driving shareholder value, generating revenues, and so on and so forth. So the company culture began to shift, you know, and it caused some tension and some consternation between the old engineering folks and then these, you know, new people coming in who were more driven by revenues and profitability and making sure that the shareholders are getting a good return on their investment and so on and so forth. And you know, they did things like move their headquarters out of where all the engineering was done back in the state of Washington in Seattle to Chicago. And they really started, you know, even more focusing on the globalization of their supply chain and, you know, getting all kinds of parts from all different kinds of places. As a result, you know, over decades that culture shifted and resulted in, you know, some horrific events.
Yeah, we're not just watering down soup. We're talking about lives here.
Yeah, we're talking about lives that were lost. And then what happens to shareholder value, right?
Oh, yeah. That's such a good point because now the value of the stock keeps declining. And so Boeing is trying to respond and replace. They just replaced, was it the CEO of the commercial aircraft unit in 2019? The president and CEO was ousted with, you know, David Calhoun taking his place. So we thought, oh, the problem's going to be solved. Well, they just fired David Calhoun here recently, right? Now he's being replaced by someone else. So sometimes just changing the leadership at the top is not enough. You have created this culture that is going to take a long time to be able to shift. And that's why, you know, surround yourself with good people. I have a story of somebody I know personally that's worked that worked for Boeing very recently. And this was a person who loves the aviation industry, and Boeing was his dream job. And he reached out to me at one point, absolutely distraught. I mean, I don't want to go into any of the details, but it was catastrophic for him personally. What did he do that caused Boeing to fire him? He took initiative with some other pilots and some other engineers to see if they could figure out how to solve the problem that we've just been talking about, and was fired because of it. Did it on his own time, and you know, maybe he didn't go through the right channels, but was just trying to come up with solutions and ideas. But somebody who was trying to help the situation was fired, and this was his dream job. And so what did I suggest? Go to Airbus. Go find a job at Airbus, the competitor, and that's what he's doing. They're losing good people that care because the culture is they don't treat people the way we're talking about. They don't value people. They value profit.
Well, and that's, you know, I know that's, you know, it's a sample size of one, and you know,
it is a sample size.
Well, you know, there may be other people that are having a stellar experience, and that's great. But I think what we're illustrating here is that culture can Yeah, here's Quinn. You know, Boeing watered down quality, engagement, team ownership for short term profitability and control drove the best employees away from the company. I don't think that Boeing's situation is an isolated situation, right? This happens in a lot of organizations who, you know, with changes in leadership and changes in focus of the board, you know, they try to steer the ship in a different direction. And sometimes it works out great, and sometimes it has all kinds of unfortunate impacts. And certainly that seems to be the case with Boeing. I'm sure that, you know, all the business schools are going to have case studies for years written about Boeing, just like they did about Ford and the Pinto in the 1970s. You know, when you went to business school, that was one of the big case studies that everybody was talking about, you know, Ford Pinto and how they value a life. And, you know,
what well, I sure hope we read about the case study of them turning it around, because I'm cheering for their success, not their demise.
Yeah. I mean, same. Me too. And, you know, as someone who spent a lot of time on planes, and you have too, you know, you know, it used to be, you know, the phrase used to be back in the day, if it ain't Boeing, I ain't going, right? If it ain't Boeing, I ain't going. That was the phrase, because Boeing had such a stellar reputation for quality, right? So that's what they were known for. That was really how they drove value, is that the products that they put out in the market were above reproach. I mean, they were very high quality. And then over time that has changed, and that's allowed their primary competitor Airbus to overtake them, you know, in terms of their global position in commercial aerospace. And so it's a cautionary tale, no doubt.
My favorite seat's right next to that exit window, so that's a dangerous seat, I guess, right?
Yeah, I got to make sure the door's bolted properly.
Well, wow. Listen, we've gone long here as usual.
Yeah.
But you know, I share all of this. I'm actually releasing on our Teamwork a Better Way newsletter tomorrow this article that I wrote about Kelvin and my interview with him. This philosophy infused everything that he did, and the result is, you may not agree, you know, another one of his philosophies that tied into this was he who is greatest among you, let him be the servant of all. And that's a principle, I think, you know, religious or non-religious, it speaks to a lot of people. We teach servant leadership, right? And that was his belief. He treated people as if they were more, and it had such a positive impact on my life. I can't deny it. And so let me just close with one more story, if you don't mind. My experience mirrors the beliefs of another great business leader, Clayton Christensen, who was a consultant for, he's the one who created the innovator's dilemma, right? He's the one who created the whole disruptive technology idea, you know, that Netflix disrupted Blockbuster and Uber, you know, the taxi system. That was his brainchild, and how you avoid being disrupted and how you disrupt yourself. And brilliant, brilliant man, taught at the Harvard Business School until a couple of years ago when he passed away, was my son-in-law's professor, just revered by people all over the world. And his business philosophy was that management is the most noble of professions if it is practiced well. And here's why. He says, no other profession or occupation offers as many ways to help people learn and grow and take responsibility and be recognized for achievement and contribute to the success of the team. So in a way, that's very similar in its approach, in its philosophy, is it is the most noble of all professions if practiced well. Why? Because you make people important. and you make them of great worth, even of divine worth. So the divinity of the human soul paramount, I think we could use a little bit more of that philosophy in the world today. I think too few of the people who, you know, I meet have had a boss like Kelvin. And I too often hear frustrated employees and their experiences. My intention by sharing this story and with that title is to be able to lift people up, to help them to be better as a leader. To, yes, to your question, can anybody do that? I believe they can. It's making that important to you, a part of your value. And how you do that is the way you build trust. That's your authentic style. It'll be different than Kelvin's. So that's what I have to say about that.
Well, I love those parting words, Spencer. Another great hour of conversation, and thanks to the viewers who chimed in. And we appreciate you, Quinn and Arsal. Thank you so much for joining us today. And Spencer, you've helped teams around the world become high-performing teams. If viewers or listeners are interested in learning more about how you could potentially help them, please let us know how we can get in touch with you.
Man, I love it when people are reaching out to me on LinkedIn, and keep doing that. So how about you? Oh, we got one more comment before we go away. Say, let's see. Yeah, you're right. You're right, Quinn. Command and control doesn't really work. So that servant leadership that we're talking about is that was his philosophy, and even taking it to another higher level and just how he saw people. So Christian, you have so much to offer people. How do people find you? I know you're changing the world right now in the state of Utah.
LinkedIn. Yeah, that's easy. It's just look me up on LinkedIn. Happy to connect with anyone. And so thank you very much for a wonderful beginning to April. Hopefully the weather will become more mild as the month progresses. And listeners, viewers, thank you again for joining us as well. We really appreciate it.
Please share it. Subscribe to the podcast. Share this podcast.
Share it out there. Yes. And we'll catch you again soon. Thank you so much.